Welcome to HN Pod, your daily dose of the top stories, trends, and debates from Hacker News. I am Sarah.
And I am Mike. Thanks for joining us. Today is Sunday, April 19th, 2026, and this is episode 370. We are going to be diving into the top stories from yesterday, April 18th, and we have a really fantastic lineup for you today.
We really do. We are looking at a masterclass in zero downtime server migration, some deep dive tokenomics on Anthropic's new Opus 4.7 model, a big 2026 update for the open source video editor Kaden Live, a fascinating look at why Japan's railways are so incredibly good, and finally, we will geek out over a teardown of the electromechanical computer inside a B-52 bomber.
Let us jump right into that first story. It is a blog post by Isa Yetter titled Migrating from DigitalOcean to Hetzner from $1,432 to $233 a month with zero downtime. This post blew up on Hacker News, pulling in over 700 points.
It is such a relatable problem right now. The author runs a software company in Turkey, and with the skyrocketing inflation and the weakening of the Turkish lira against the US dollar, their infrastructure costs were just becoming completely unmanageable. They were paying over $1,400 a month to DigitalOcean for a droplet with 192 gigs of RAM and 32 vCPUs.
Right, and they realized they could move to a Hetzner dedicated server with an AMD EPYC processor, 48 cores, 256 gigs of DDR5 RAM, and almost 2 terabytes of NVMe storage for just $233 a month. That is over $14,000 saved a year for a machine that is objectively way more powerful. But the real star of this post is how they actually pulled it off without taking their services offline.
Exactly. This was not a small weekend project. They had 30 MySQL databases with about 250 gigabytes of data, 34 Nginx sites, GitLab, a Neo4j graph database, and live mobile app traffic. They executed a 6-phase migration plan that is honestly a textbook example of how to do DevOps right.
The database migration part was especially slick. Instead of the old dump and restore method that forces you to take everything offline, they set up live replication. They used a tool called MyDumper, which leveraged the new server's 48 cores to do parallel exporting and importing. Then they set the old server as the master and the new one as a read-only slave, syncing them perfectly until the final cutover.
And for the web traffic, they scripted the DigitalOcean DNS API to drop the time to live on their records to 300 seconds. While that propagated, they converted the Nginx server blocks on the old server to act as reverse proxies, pointing to the new server. So if a user's DNS still pointed to the old IP, the request was just silently forwarded. Nobody noticed a thing.
The comments on this thread were super interesting, especially regarding how AI is changing these kinds of migrations. Salvatore Sanfilippo, known as Anchores, the creator of Redis, chimed in. He said he recently moved 2 messy servers from Linode and DigitalOcean to Hetzner, and he just had Claude Code do the entire migration. He said it even rewrote parts of the code when obsolete libraries were no longer available.
That sparked a huge debate. One commenter pointed out that in the cloud era, nobody is really paying for magic compute. They are paying to not touch 10 years of infrastructure glue. If AI agents can just eat that glue and untangle the mess, the moat for these big cloud providers gets very thin, very fast.
Though, of course, because it is Hacker News, the mention of Claude immediately derailed into a conversation about AI astroturfing. Several people mentioned seeing suspicious Reddit and forum accounts constantly talking up how scary good the new Claude models are. It is a real problem right now, trying to figure out what is genuine developer enthusiasm and what is a bot farming engagement.
Which actually transitions us perfectly into our next story, which is all about Anthropic's latest models. The post is called Anonymous Request Token Comparisons from Opus 4.6 and Opus 4.7. It is a community leaderboard built by Bill Chambers that tracks how the two models differ on real inputs.
The data here is fascinating. If you look at the total cost, Opus 4.7 produces significantly fewer output tokens than 4.6, and the reasoning cost has been cut almost in half. So on paper, 4.7 is slightly cheaper to run than 4.6, especially for reasoning-heavy tasks.
But the Hacker News comments reveal a much more complicated reality on the ground. A user named Matthias Morera pointed out that 4.7 produces fewer tokens because Anthropic has forced adaptive thinking on, and API users cannot disable it.
This is causing some serious quality issues.
Yeah, people are complaining that the model is making really basic mistakes because it is constantly second-guessing itself. One user shared a transcript where the model spent a huge amount of time turning tokens only to lazily hand-wave away a complex coding problem. When the user confronted the AI about it, the AI literally replied, "Fair call, I was pattern matching without actually reading the code. Let me do the work properly."
It is so frustrating for developers. You have this model on maximum effort, paying for it to think, and it just talks itself out of the right answer. Another commenter noted that asking an LLM why it did something is usually pointless anyway, because it cannot actually introspect on its prior internal state. It just hallucinates a statistically plausible excuse.
The current workaround seems to be prompt engineering. People are finding that if you tell the model to take a step back and look at things from a different angle, it adds enough entropy to get it out of whatever local optimum it is stuck in. But as one user complained, it feels like modern tooling relies on performing the correct prayer to the machine spirit just to get your code written.
Let us shift gears away from AI for a moment and talk about the open source world. Our third story is the state of KdenLive 2026. For those who might not know, KdenLive is a popular open source video editor built on the KDE framework.
They just put out their roadmap in review, and it looks like they have found a really great balance between adding new features and focusing on stability. The big shiny new toy in their April release is an object segmentation plugin based on the SAM2 model, which lets you automatically mask and remove any selected object from the background.
They also rewrote their open timeline I/O import and export using C++, which makes it way easier to exchange projects with other editing software. Plus, they gave their audio waveform generation a massive 300% performance boost.
The Hacker News community has a lot of love for KdenLive. A user named VizioHex summed up the general feeling perfectly, saying it hits the absolute sweet spot. It is much more capable than basic editors like iMovie, but it doesn't have the overwhelming learning curve or the steep hardware requirements of DaVinci Resolve.
Exactly. A lot of people were sharing their 100% free and open source media stacks, pairing KdenLive with OBS for screen recording and Audacity, or Tenacity, for audio. It's incredible how far open source video editing has come. You can run a whole YouTube channel on free tools now.
There was a bit of a debate in the comments about stability, though. One user warned that for serious professional projects, KdenLive still has a tendency to crash and potentially corrupt work, advising people to just buy DaVinci Resolve instead. But others pushed back, noting that even industry standards like Adobe Premiere Pro are notorious for mid-project crashes.
Yeah, the consensus seems to be that while it might not replace Avid or Premiere in a Hollywood editing bay, for the vast majority of creators, hobbyists, and developers making demo videos, KdenLive is an incredibly powerful tool that just lives on your machine, ready to go whenever you need it.
Moving on to our fourth story, we have a fantastic piece from Works in Progress magazine titled Why Japan Has Such Good Railways. This one got a lot of traction, over 300 points.
I loved this article. It tackles this common myth that Japan's amazing public transit is just a product of their culture. You know, this idea that Japanese people are naturally conformist and love taking trains, unlike Americans who love the freedom of the open road.
Right, the authors completely dismantle that. They point out that Japanese people actually love cars, but they take trains because the system is objectively the best in the world, and it is the best because of brilliant public policy and a very unique business model.
The core of it is how Japan handles private railway companies. In most countries, transit creates a ton of economic value for the areas around the stations, but the transit agency cannot capture that value. They only get the fare from the ticket. So transit always runs at a massive loss and needs government subsidies.
But in Japan, the railway companies are allowed to be real estate developers. The article uses the Tokyu Corporation as an example. You do not just ride a Tokyu train. You live in a Tokyu apartment building, buy groceries at a Tokyu supermarket, work in a Tokyu office, and go to a Tokyu amusement park on the weekend.
It is called railway-led urbanism. They build the city, and then they build the train to connect the pieces of the city they just built. Because they own the destinations, they capture all the positive economic spillover that the train creates. It is a completely different way of thinking about infrastructure.
The comments on Hacker News brought up another massive factor that the article touches on, which is parking policy. In Japan, you literally cannot buy a car unless you can prove to the local police that you have a reserved off-street parking space for it.
Yes, a commenter named Van Tassel pointed this out, referencing Donald Shoup's famous book, The High Price of Free Parking. In the US and Europe, we socialized the cost of storing private vehicles by letting people park on public streets for free or very cheap. Japan made that illegal.
It completely changes the geometry of a city. Because streets are not lined with parked cars, they can be narrower, safer for pedestrians and bikes, and the land is used for productive things instead of just storing empty metal boxes. It sparked a huge debate in the thread about American zoning laws and how removing surface parking lots in downtown areas is the lowest hanging fruit for fixing US cities.
It really makes you realize how much our physical environment is dictated by invisible policy choices made decades ago. Speaking of incredible engineering from decades ago, that brings us to our final story today.
This is a classic Hacker News post from Ken Sheriff's blog. It is a teardown titled "The Electromechanical Angle Computer Inside the B-52 Bomber's Star Tracker."
Ken Sheriff does these amazing reverse engineering deep dives, and this one is mind-blowing. He looks at how aircraft navigated in the early 1960s, before GPS existed. They used celestial navigation, steering by the stars, but doing that manually is incredibly difficult and slow.
So the military built this automated system for the B-52 called the Astrocompass. It had a telescope that stuck out of the top of the fuselage to track stars. But the really crazy part is how it did the math. Digital computers back then were too big, too slow, and too unreliable.
So they built an analog electromechanical computer. Ken has these beautiful photos of the inside of the Engel computer. It is this dense, heavy block of gears, motors, and synchros. It physically models the celestial sphere inside the box. There is a mechanism that actually moves a pointer to represent the position of a star, and then it reads the angles out electrically to the navigation system.
The user interface is wild, too. The navigator had to look up star positions in this massive government book called the Air Almanac, which was updated every 4 months. Then they would input the data into the machine using these physical knobs. Every knob had a different geometric shape, so the navigator could tell them apart just by feel in the dark.
The Hacker News comments were equal parts awe and existential dread. One person said, "Every time I read articles like this, I envy the engineers that worked on such tools, and here I am fighting GitLab pipelines."
I totally get that feeling. There is something so tangible and permanent about designing a physical computer out of gears that will survive a nuclear blast, compared to wrestling with a YAML file that breaks because someone updated a node module.
Though, as another commenter rightly pointed out, it is a bit of a shame that historically, the only way to get the funding to work on engineering problems of this magnitude was to build tools of war. The B-52 wasn't dropping care packages after all. It is a heavy ethical trade-off that still exists in the tech industry today, especially with the AI defense contracts we see now.
It is the eternal duality of engineering, incredible human ingenuity applied to some very dark purposes. But purely from a mechanical standpoint, Ken's teardown is an absolute must-read if you appreciate hardware.
Well, that is going to do it for us today. We went from the cutting edge of AI models and zero downtime cloud migrations all the way back to the analog gears of Cold War bombers, with a nice detour through Japanese city planning.
Just a typical day on Hacker News. Thanks so much for listening to episode 370 of HN Pod. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend or colleague.
We will be back tomorrow with a fresh batch of the top stories. Until then, keep building and have a great day.